Podcast. I'm Leonie Smith, sometimes known as the Cybersafety Lady. I'm a cybersafety educator, and this podcast is all about learning how to use the digital technology in our homes with more safety and balance. My guest today is Brad Marshall, sometimes known as the Unplugged Psychologist. Brad Marshall is a psychologist and director of the Internet Addiction Clinic at Kidspace in Sydney. He is recognised as one of Australia's leading experts in gaming screen addiction, or what is known as problematic internet use, PIU. We're going to hear all about that during the podcast, what the difference is between the two. Brad's most recent project, The Unplugged Psychologist, provides free tips and strategies to parents in conjunction with the release of his book, The Tech Diet for Your Child and Teen, which is published by HarperCollins. Brad is also a well-respected guest speaker, delivering seminars for students, parents, educators, and corporate audiences on finding a balanced tech diet at home and at school. He provides a common sense, humorous, and practical voice on complex parenting topics. Brad Marshall, welcome to the Digital Families Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Brad, there is understandably some confusion about those two terms. What is the difference between addiction and problematic internet use, which is, of course, a lot harder to say?
Yeah.
Can you also explain why they changed the terminology?
Okay, so I think the confusion even goes back 10, 20 years. It was originally called internet addiction by sort of the founder of this field, Dr. Kimberly Young in America, who's unfortunately since passed away. And there've been many different iterations of what it's been called since, you know, screen disorder, gaming disorder, internet gaming disorder, problematic use, hazardous gaming, I can go on. And I think that that's one of the issues with the academic world, because my hat's usually 90% clinical, but I've in the last few years gone, dip my toe into the academia world and the research world. And one of the issues that we have is there's so many different terms used that it confuses the research and it therefore confuses the greater community. So I quite often, people can get very upset about this. Leonie, I've had other people in the field get very angry with me for calling my clinic the Internet Addiction Clinic. Mm-hmm. But I guess you have to keep in mind here, it's not because I'm endorsing the term addiction. I'm simply calling my clinic what most parents refer to this problem as. So in 2010, when I opened my clinic, that's what parents were typing into Google and saying, I have a son or a child with internet addiction or gaming addiction.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm not a big fan of worrying too much about what we call it. And I use the terms interchangeably. But what the research tells us is that for kids in Australia, when you look at the prevalence rates, there is about 1 to 3% of children that are at the extreme end, if you will, and they would be categorized as something like gaming disorder or internet gaming disorder, which are now ratified by the World Health Organization and almost ratified by the DSM. You then have this category between sort of 1 in 3 and 10% of children that they categorize, depending on different views, as something like problematic internet usage, PIU, or hazardous gaming, if you will. And so they're kind of what I would say would be subclinical kids. And then you have 80 or 90% of the rest of the kids, right? So 80 to 90% of kids have zero problems in this or might be approaching that area. But I think it's helpful to use it as a bit of a sliding scale, if you will. Some kids that are having normal use as they go along might slide into that problematic use, and then they might slide even further, and other kids can go the other way as well. Does that kind of answer your question, Leonie?
Yeah, it does, actually. It makes it a lot clearer. And I can understand why you wouldn't want to call your clinic, you know, the unplugged problematic internet user.
All of the above.
And I agree with you, because when parents talk to me about their children's screen time, some of them will exactly say that. My kid's addicted too.
Right.
And, you know, as a non-clinician, I can't, you know, determine for them whether that is an addiction or not, but can certainly point them in the right direction. And on that question, Brad, at what stage in that graph that you've just given us do parents bring their concerns to you?
So look, it can be a wide range. I certainly have kids, and in my latest study that I'm publishing at Macquarie University with Professor Wayne Warburton, we'll be showing that there is a small snapshot of kids that come to my clinic that certainly do qualify for the gaming disorder or the internet gaming disorder. And that would be the vast chunk of kids. And again, you've got to remember here, I think the latest statistics are there's something like 4 or 5 million children in Australia, right, in the Australian population. So if you just overlay 1 to 3%, it's a pretty big number. So people at home quite often think, oh, this is something that's just, you know, 1 in a million chance. It's really not. But to answer your question, there are plenty of kids that would be in that subclinical category where the parents have caught it earlier. And there are plenty of kids where they're still, in my view, in the normal use, but the parents are concerned about, you know, maybe they're 8 or 10 and they start to exhibit some of these behaviors, and we don't want them sliding into that area. And I certainly encourage that for parents to seek help early and put things in place early, because prevention is always better than treatment or a cure, right?
Yeah, and I'm wondering, Brad, out of the statistics that you have there about children, is there a concern that there are a lot of children that possibly should be diagnosed with those two top levels that are falling through the cracks? So is there a sort of really an unknown amount of kids that could fall into that category? Or are you pretty safe to assume that it is the percentages that you've just given us?
No, look, the data around prevalence rates is very well established. So the statistics that I gave you are Australian data, and that's by Wayne Warburton, Professor Daniel King at Flinders University. We have some of the best prevalence studies on this in the world. You have to keep in mind there are other countries in the world like Singapore or Korea where those numbers are way higher, right? Their internet gaming or gaming disorder numbers can be up around 10%, and their subclinical numbers can be up around 20 or 30%. So those are just Australian numbers, and they're pretty well established and grounded in research. But the issue then is recognizing those kids in the community, in schools, in families, and then how do they get help? Because there is no national structure or approach to treatment and getting help in this country. So, you know, it's myself and a few other people. Dr. Kim Lee is a child psychiatrist, Dr. Philip Tam. But, you know, outside of that, there's not a whole lot of people that can actually do the 1% to 3% that I'm referring to there. And there's no national approach.
Yes, yeah, so that puts parents in a really tricky situation. Even if they're looking to have their child assessed, where do they go if there's no national approach? And it is a very specific area of expertise, I imagine, because it's involving all the technology around it. I know I get queries from parents all the time who want me to be able to help them. And in my capacity, I can only help them with technical advice. I can't help them with the psychological approach. That is somewhere that I have to refer them onto. And for parents, that's incredibly frustrating. What are the signs for parents to know about that maybe their child actually has one of these categories, the high-level category or the problematic internet use, rather than just a bad habit? How do they determine that for themselves so that they know whether to take that next step of looking for help?
Yeah, so, I mean, look, I could answer that question by quoting a whole bunch of diagnostic criteria from the DSM or the WHO, but I'm not going to do that because I think parents will get overwhelmed. I think in my experience, it can just become very difficult, not practical. So the way that I explain this to parents in my clinic and at talks is that essentially what I encourage parents to do is look at the different developmental domains that their child is sort of veering in. So social development, emotional development, behavior, education, and health. Health is not technically a developmental domain, but what I mean by that is how are they tracking in their sleep, their eating, their exercise, that sort of stuff. And so if you have, for example, a year 8 boy, and I always use years rather than ages, right? Because I think it's easier to compare other year 8 boys or girls and you just sort of stick around that. And you would want to be looking at in their development, how is their behavior? So if a parent comes in and says to me, oh, look, their behavior is horrible when I take the screens off them. I mean, they mutter under their breath and they walk into their room. The conclusion for me may be to say to that parent, look, I don't know that that's all that different to what a typical year eight boy would do. I'm not discounting the fact that it's not great, but that's a teenage boy, right? Mm. On the other hand, and I'm going to jump to an extreme here, there are many other variations, but if they're saying to me, which is a very common occurrence, they assault someone in the house and police are called, or there are holes in the walls, or they're throwing glasses when I'm taking screens or trying to set boundaries around it, that is, in my view, beyond what an average year eight boy would be doing. So in any of those developmental domains that I'm referring to there, parents would be encouraged to look at that. So take the education developmental domain. Is it normal for a year eight boy to not want to do his homework and grumble and avoid it and probably do it a bit dodgy, to be honest with you, and like rush through it? Yeah, of course it is, right? Is it normal for them to just not hand anything in and not go to school on certain days? No, that is beyond what we would consider, you know, normal development. And that might, again, be another warning sign that this has gotten a little bit further or a little bit out of control and you have a problem with the gaming or the screens.
Yeah, and I guess there isn't a one-size-fits-all either. I mean, you might have somebody that appears to have a real problem that doesn't get violent at all, but they find all kinds of other sneaky ways of getting on that device to the point where, you know, it becomes a cat and a mouse game with a parent. So not all children will present with the sort of violent side of it or necessarily skip school, but they're doing absolutely everything else to be connected.
Correct. And that's what I refer to in my book and my videos is guerrilla warfare, because that's kind of, you know, the sneaking around and the commando roles to find the devices and stuff. Yeah. And I've seen every version of guerrilla warfare you can possibly imagine, Leonie. I have literally seen kids that have done, you know, tied bed sheets together and gone from a second story to a first to go through a window in the middle of the night, proper Shawshank Redemption style, you know. And I think, so I guess what I would say to that, though, is even if they're not being violent or missing school, you are going to see that in other domains. Mm. They're not going to be going out with their friends as much as they should, or a year eight boy should in that example. They're not going to be getting their homework done. It still will become pervasive in one or two or three of those developmental domains. It might impact their sleep. So even if they're managing their behavior and their school stuff, it's going to bubble out somewhere.
Yeah. And I imagine, Brad, like everything else, you've most likely seen a huge uptake or an uptick, I should say, in prevalence of people contacting you over the period of COVID over the last year. What sort of percentage increase have you seen and what kinds of behaviour are you seeing as a result of that?
So to answer the second part first, to me there's no difference in the behaviour that I'm seeing since COVID than what I've seen in the last 10 years.
Okay.
There's always been these problems. But going back to the first part of your question, yes, it is more common for me to be getting emails from frantic parents or phone calls and whatnot, and more referrals to the clinic. I can't put some solid numbers around it because, to be completely honest, my wait list before COVID was sort of 4 to 6 months, and my wait list now is 4 to 6 months. And I don't normally let it get any longer than that, because if it's going to be any longer than that, I typically will email a parent and sort of offer other options, although it's difficult because there's not many.
Yeah.
One thing that did help a little bit is I got less international and sort of even interstate inquiries since COVID, because people couldn't travel and stuff, although some people are now doing it via Zoom. So there's definitely been an increase, and a lot of that was around that first lockdown that most of us experienced, in that when homeschooling occurred, parents had to let go of the reins quite a bit. And I was one of the people saying to parents, look, this is a world pandemic, just do what you got to do, right?
Yeah.
We shouldn't be too worried about that. But there were a lot of parents then that struggled to reestablish those boundaries.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes, I was also made aware of that as well with the types of inquiries that I were getting. So on a practical level, Brad, let's talk to parents that have got a small child who throws a tantrum every time they have to put down their device. And we know, as I'm a parent myself, Sometimes you just want a quiet life. You don't want to deal with the conflict that happens. What are the best steps for parents in that sort of situation where they've got a, you know, primary school kid or a younger child who has that sort of tantrum reaction every time the parent tries to limit their screen time?
Sure. So this is what my book takes people through and how to do this. But to give you the shorter answer, there are a few different categories here. If you have a preschool child, so if you have a preschool or a smaller child, there's going to be much less use. And parents can just manage that by taking devices off them. You give them the iPad for half an hour, and they, you know, you take it off them. Excuse me. And the problem that parents seem to have is that at some point in primary school, and it's getting younger, by the way, in the last 10 years, in my experience, at some point that strategy no longer works. And this is where I do veer off a little bit from what perhaps the wider community in this space does recommend, because most parents say to me, well, everyone just tells me just to sort of man up and be a parent and take the device.
Yeah.
But in my experience, that's actually the most useless information parents can get. For 80% of parents, they'll be able to do that, and that's fine. But they're the 80% that we referred to before, where their kids just don't have much of a problem with this. I'm talking about the other 10 or 20%. And in that case, what I typically recommend is, yes, take the devices if you're able to and if they're willing to, but there'll be some point, whether it be 8 years old, 12 years old, 14 years old, where that child is going to start to buck that. Yeah.
They might also start to, you know, grow a bit taller and a bit hairier.
Absolutely.
And start to push back.
Yep. And so at that point, I recommend that parents take control of the Wi-Fi and the mobile data. And I'll give you the quick version of how to do this, because I think in parents' defense, they've been sold every sort of iteration of parental control and everything else on the market. But for the 10 to 20% that we've been talking about here, Leonie, it doesn't work. I've seen kids break pretty much every single software solution that is out there. So essentially what I'm honing in on right as we speak, and actually earlier this morning I was speaking to a tech company that's helping me with this, is helping parents to which router and which modem actually allows you to do this at home. And so the point of that being that if you can remove the Wi-Fi connection remotely, you're going to get less of a tech tantrum, okay? And that's to do with attachment theory, and I'm not going to bother people with that, but essentially the less hands-on you are with this stuff and the more you can do it remotely, then it will calm down quicker. And so then parents managing that internet remotely is very key. Now, a lot of families do then say, oh, but, you know, then they're just going to have their screen and they'll offline game. Well, you know, the research again tells us, and this dates back to 2014 in a Scandinavian study, that there is far more dopamine that goes to the brain when you are doing online things. So without the internet, and this is fundamentally why back in the day I called it internet addiction, is without the internet, that device is pretty useless. Barring some children with some developmental disorders like autism, they're going to get bored of that. It's like me gaming in the 80s, right? You're just playing a computer and there's far less dopamine to the brain. So parents get stuck quite often with this trap of control the devices. But there are often like 10 or 12 devices in a house, right? And that's where the guerrilla warfare comes in. So I move more towards control the Wi-Fi, control the mobile data.
So I'm going to throw you a curly one.
Sure.
With that, as a person who works in this space. And I also have had a child that had problematic internet use.
Okay.
And I'll tell you a little story that happened to me when my oldest stepson, who is now 38, had an addiction to our television. And we had one of those little rabbit ear aerials. So I cleverly thought, I will take the aerial away with me when I leave the house, because he was a lot old enough to be in the house, and put it in the car and drive it around with me. Several weeks later, you know, feeling very proud of myself that I'd stopped that, I was cleaning up the downstairs room, and guess what I found under the cupboard in the stairs?
Spare antennas.
So this is the story I tell parents, Bran. Mm. There is also other workarounds with that. So one of the things that I have suggested to parents, and you can tell me whether I'm completely dreaming or not, is not just to do that, to limit the to do the Wi-Fi, because there are always workarounds. Kids will get a loaner device from someone else. They'll figure out a way of getting data, even if it means sitting outside somebody's house and hacking into their Wi-Fi or whatever it might be, is to create a system where they are rewarded for limiting their screen time or their Wi-Fi use. Because in the longer term, when they get to the point of being 16 or 17 and they have to have more time by themselves with their device, they must have the tools to learn how to limit their screen time and to do all of that. And it might be a combination of rewards for getting off their device. And it's always preferable to have rewards rather than consequences, or the other way. Is that realistic in any way, shape or form to try and set up that kind of system that has more longer term effects than trying to play this cat and mouse game with them, with trying to always trying to outsmart them with the technology?
So let me go back to the rabbit ear stuff first, the TV stuff. I think what I would say is that the research tells us there are very few children, and maybe you just had the exception with your stepson, that are going to get, you know, addicted or stuck on old school television, right?
Yeah, that's right. I know.
So You had a curly. I think that for the masses, for the 99.9%, for TV these days, if you remove the Wi-Fi from a TV, and they can't watch YouTube and Netflix and all the rest of it, then they're in old school. They're watching like Ready, Steady, Cook at 3 p.m. I don't even know if that's still on, Leonie. But anyway, I guess they're watching old school stuff and they're not going to do that, okay? Functional MRI studies tell us that there's not as enough dopamine going to the brain when they do that. They're not going to do it.
But they can always hotspot from a device.
No, so that's why I said to you, in the plan that I roll out, it's Wi-Fi and mobile data. So
yeah, you'd
yes,
have to
you're
limit
correct,
that data.
Right? Mm. And you've got to limit that data. Mm. And again, families don't get handballed this by the phone companies. The phone companies are constantly upping the data and doing family sharing and all these other things that undermine that, right?
That's exactly right. And they're going to give us unlimited data on our phones very, very quickly. The US have had it for years and years. They can't understand why we have different data plans.
Correct. But again, so for parents in my clinic and that watch my videos, they typically go with something like an Amaysim prepaid $10 a month, 3 gigabyte. Why 3 gigabyte? Because then their teenagers still have enough data to communicate with their friends. I'm not trying to stop them from socializing. In fact, it's the opposite. I want them to, right?
Yeah.
But not enough to hotspot and undermine the Wi-Fi settings at home, okay? Mm-hmm. When it comes to the idea of rewarding getting off, I guess I have a similar idea where I reward them using screen time and internet time for doing other things that tick the boxes in those developmental domains.
Okay.
So if you do your homework, you get time. If you go to sport, you get time. If you get to bed on time, you get time. So it's similar, just slightly different way that it's framed. I don't know that I 100% agree that by the time a child is 16 or 17, that they should be expected to be able to manage their use.
Mm.
I know that that's what we expect because we call a child an adult at 18. I understand that. But all of the neuroscience basically rebukes that, right? So the parts of the brain, especially for boys, that are responsible for impulse control and emotional control are things called the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala for parents at home. And we know that for boys, that doesn't fully develop until mid to late 20s. So this idea that we need to teach them how to manage all of this by the time they're 16 or 18 is kind of laughable, if I'm honest. Now, for 80 or 90% of kids, they might be able to do it. I'm not saying all children, right? What I'm talking about, again, is that 5 to 10%. Yeah. So this idea
I guess
that
the reason I came up with that is because that's by the time they're in senior years of high school.
Sure.
And it's most likely that most kids in the senior years of high school, with a few exceptions, will be doing most of their schoolwork in their rooms because of distractions and all that kind of stuff. So that's crucial for them, for their ability to do all the work that they need to do, that they can manage that. And, of course, that often doesn't come naturally to kids. They need a lot of guidance with how to do that. And I know a lot of schools spend an enormous amount of time now bringing experts in and talking to them about scheduling that time. So without a parent completely hovering over them the whole time when they're trying to do that, what kind of advice would you give to parents to help teenagers with that then?
So again, 80 to 90% of year 11 or year 12s are not going to have major problems with this. They're going to be able to do it by then. They will have developed neurologically enough to kind of get, you know, distracted sometimes, but get through it. What we're talking about is that, you know, 5 to 10% that struggle with this area.
Yeah.
In very extreme cases, I've had to have schools just go back to paper and pencil stuff because there is just no way that they can be using computers. But in an ideal world, what I move more towards, again, is Wi-Fi being off during that.
And can I just stop you for one second? Did you just say that the schools are going to pencil or paper, or the individual children you're recommending?
Sorry, the individual children is. So I work with schools around, look, this child for the last 3-4 years has not been able to do this with a screen. Yeah. What do we do? But typically schools will be helped and parents. And I just had a child last night telling me, you know, that he or she couldn't possibly do any homework because mum and dad, you know, turned the Wi-Fi off. And I turned around and said, really? Because, you know, you've got screenshots that you could take for all of this stuff. She said, oh, yeah, but it's on the portal online, like my assessment. I said, sure. So you could jump online and take screenshots of all that, and that would take 2 minutes, and then you would have the rest of the time offline to do it.
Mm.
And kids quite often are not even trying to be difficult about this. They just genuinely don't even understand that there's an option to do that offline. So there's some assignment where you've got to have a few things and you've got to write a Word document and whatnot. And she said, oh, well, how would I save it then? He or she said, how would I save it then? Because I need Wi-Fi. And I sort of sat there thinking, you can save it to the desktop. It's fine, right? But again, it's not them being difficult. So if you have that scenario in year 11 and year 12, you just need to gear more towards, no problem, you can have a laptop. You've got PowerPoint, you've got Word, you've got all these things. And anything that you need that's on a server or, you know, Canvas or any of these other things that schools use, we'll take screenshots, it'll be on your desktop. And then you work for an hour or two on this project offline. And if you speak to most schools, which I do on a daily basis, most year or house coordinators will tell you that 80 to 90% of it could be done offline.
And in fact, there are some schools that have gone back to pencil and paper
for
a lot of their work. I've taught at a couple of them and, you know, I've sort of said, well, you know, how do you look things up? And they go, oh, well, you know, pencil and paper. And I think that SBS did a very interesting discussion, didn't they, about this whole scenario on one of the, it might have been one of the Insight programs where a couple of the kids were talking about how they work with pencil and paper, and they actually found the pencil and paper gave them the ability to really remember things better than just using the screen. So there's some benefits there.
Absolutely.
So winding up, Brad, I didn't get to nearly anywhere near the amount of questions that I had for you. One of my passions with all of this is trying to make the industries that develop all this technology, including the hardware developers and the software developers, to be more responsible for the way they're designing these products, because they're designing them to be more and more addictive. Do you have any insight out there for what is happening in that field as to whether governments around the world do actually have any chance at all of making these companies more responsible? And how much responsibility do you put on the shoulders of these companies?
From my perspective, I put responsibility in three places. I put responsibility in the family home and the parents. I put responsibility on tech and gaming companies, and I put responsibility on the government. And I'm not going to go so far as to say what percentage it should be in each place. But all three areas, and I suppose you could add schools into that as well to a lesser degree, but there needs to be responsibility on all parts. And I feel that at the moment it is solely on the parents to solve this issue and schools. I don't feel that any tech companies, gaming or social media or whatever it may be, have made any meaningful changes. So in my experience, if you look at the parental control stuff that they actually bring out, it's laughable how easy it is to get around.
Yeah.
laughable. I mean, 5 minutes. There are so many holes in it. And you cannot tell me that every tech company in the world or gaming company in the world with the most intelligent IT people have just stuffed this up majorly. So, you know, that does make me a bit of a cynic, obviously.
Yes, yeah.
And I feel that equally so with the government, maybe this is because myself and colleagues in research and clinical areas in Australia have not been good enough at voicing and advocating. And maybe that's something we need to do better in future, coming together, because we all seem to work in silos in this country and we don't work together. But essentially, we haven't made governments accountable for any of this. So any of my colleagues that you speak to, whether it be research or clinical based, they all regale me with stories of meeting with a certain politician or a certain government department or, you know, certain e-safety person or whatever it may be. And anytime they're trying to get funding for research or treatment or anything like that, they get shot down. And I'm talking the most brilliant people that are recognized worldwide, right, in their field and in this field, have far bigger profile than I do, are getting shot down time and time again for anything to do with funding for treatment or research in this country. So we just put zero significance. We put a lot of significance on cyber safety. And in my view, we put very little to zero significance on the gaming and the problematic usage and the gaming disorder area.
And from my perspective, there's a lot of investment in those areas that are fighting against some of that research, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely.
Everybody's got their own reason. And as a person working in this space, one of the most frustrating things for me is the fact that there is research going on and the researchers can't even agree on on their methods of research or the outcomes. And so for leaving parents very confused, whereas you can look at other fields and it's like, this is the science, this is what we know, and this is the solution. And in this field.
Yeah. So Leonie, I complete, if you had asked me that question 2 or 3 years ago, I would have completely agreed with you. I think we are making moves in the right area. And maybe that's because I am doing more stuff in the academic area now. I think there is more consensus in Australia to try and bring people together. And things are moving, but it'll happen slowly. Look, we are very much in a similar spot to other fields like gambling addiction was in the 80s and 90s, from what I'm told, that we need to, you know, mobilize and get on the same page and then advocate for what needs to happen here and some recognition. But going back to your idea about, you know, the gaming industry or big tech companies and the research that they do, parents at home listening to this should understand. And I did a talk at a couple of weeks ago at a boys' school that I do every year in Sydney. And these are very intelligent young men. And I challenge them. I challenge them to read between the lines. A colleague of mine was recently criticized after giving an interview, saying that he was one-sided. And this person, who is a doctor in the US, quoted all this research and these videos of this other academic doctor in the US. When all it took him was 5 minutes of looking on this person's website to understand that she was funded by Riot Games and Microsoft, right? Yeah. So this is what happens here is parents get so overwhelmed by these other people shouting down research that has no axe to grind, no funding, and they don't know what the source is. So I would encourage parents to really remember, if you're ever getting information that seems a little bit on the side of gaming is great, or even just the gray, always look into where is that person funded and where are they getting their money? Because me personally, I don't get any money from any third parties that I need to walk on here and say to you, you know, I'm declaring my financial interest.
Yeah, it reminds me of the cigarette industry, doesn't it, all the way?
Sugar as well. There's a lot of similarities here.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much for your time today, Brad. It was really interesting. I love chatting with you about all of this. And for those listeners out there, if you've listened all the way through, there's a special surprise for you. Brad has kindly given our listeners a special offer on your video series, which I have been watching also, Brad, and it's absolutely brilliant.
Thank you.
If you put the discount code Digital Families, all in capital letters, into the cart, once you go to Brad's website, you will get 30% off that series. Tell us a little bit about those courses, Brad. as we're winding up?
Yeah, look, I mean, what I found was that after writing the book, lots of parents are very time poor, as you'd be familiar with, Leonie. And when they're stressed as well dealing with this stuff, they don't have time always to read a book. So I you know, did this series of videos. They're very short and sharp. You know, some of them are 3 or 4 minutes. Others are maybe 10 or 12. Mm. But it's designed so that you can kind of dip in and dip out of it. Or if you have a parent that's sort of traveling or whatever they may be doing, just watching little bits at a time. And it will take you through the steps that I've talked about and alluded to as well, and how to do this at home.
Yeah, I found them fantastic, and I'm still working my way through them, and they're absolutely brilliant. And your book, The Tech Diet for Your Child and Teen, is available from your website and all good booksellers.
Correct.
Thank you so much for being on Digital Families today, Brad Marshall.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. If any of these issues mentioned have raised any concerns for you, you can contact Beyond Blue on 1300 22 4636, Lifeline on 13 11 14, or the Kids Helpline. They have a parent line, which is absolutely brilliant, that can help you when you're really stuck, 1300 1352. Thanks for listening to the Digital Families podcast today. If you like this podcast, leave us a review or some feedback on YouTube or your favourite podcast app, wherever you're listening to us. I'd love to hear what you think. Maybe you've got a suggestion for a potential upcoming guest, and tune in next week for our next chat about all things digital and how it affects families.